pipes, for instance, where you can use copper. It's used for packaging, where you can use refillable, reusable packaging, or packaging made from recycled material, like metal, glass, cardboard, paper. It's used for toys. The iconic little yellow rubber ducky that floats around in children's bathtubs, that's made from polyvinyl chloride. Let's just ditch that ducky and have toys that do not pose a risk to kids, especially when they're chewing on the plastic. There's an abundance of alternatives to polyvinyl chloride plastic and many plastics. It's just a matter of political will, as I said. Just as we have fuel efficiency standards for cars and appliances, it's time to have environmental standards for packaging, which is a giant part of the plastic picture.
Judith Enck, we want to thank you so much for being with us, former EPA regional administrator and president of Beyond Plastics, and Monica Unseld, biologist and executive director of Until Justice Data Partners. That does it for our show. To see all our coverage of East Palestine, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! Watch all our shows online at democracynow.org.
I'm Molly, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing, unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a decision about the abortion pill mifepristone by a federal judge in Texas could jeopardize access to them in Oregon. A new group of lawsuits have been filed by Black Portlanders who say they were racially profiled in local stores. And in national news, Florida teachers' unions claim they are being targeted by Governor DeSantis. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 13th, 2023. I'm Michelle Coppola. Concerned medical professionals are sounding the alarm that a Texas decision about abortion pills could jeopardize access to them here in Oregon. Over the weekend, those healthcare providers joined Oregon Senator Ron Wyden and Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum in front of a CVS pharmacy to raise awareness about the issue. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved mifepristone in 2000 for use in terminating pregnancy. However, an upcoming ruling by a Donald Trump-appointed district court judge in Texas could effectively enact a federal ban on the medication. The Washington Post reports that this judge is one of the most conservative anti-abortion federal judges in the country. If that judge rules to revoke the FDA approval, Senator Wyden has asked President Biden to ignore that ruling because, quote, it is not based in science. When taken with a second drug, misoprostol, mifepristone is one of the safest and most effective ways to end an early pregnancy. That's according to Dr. Maria Rodriguez, a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the OHSU School of Medicine. At Sunday's press conference, Dr. Rodriguez said, quote, we know that this attack on mifepristone is going to threaten the well-being of those who are pregnant across the country. Oregon was one of the states to contribute research to the FDA approval 23 years ago. Oregon Live reports that the first hearing for the lawsuit to ban the drug, which was filed by anti-abortion groups in November, is scheduled for this Wednesday. The Republican Freedom Caucus lays out its demands to raise the debt ceiling, and Representative Jamal Bowman speaks out against what some are calling transphobic bills. With more on those stories, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Simply put, the plan is to shrink Washington and grow America.
House Freedom Caucus Chair Scott Perry is listing ways the right-wing group wants federal spending reduced in return for raising the debt ceiling. Those include ending President Biden's student loan debt forgiveness, rescinding COVID-19 relief funds, and cutting back the IRS funding and climate change prevention in last year's Inflation Reduction Act. The largely symbolic cuts would have a tiny impact on the debt, and Biden seemed unmoved.
So I urge our extreme MAGA Republican friends in the Congress to put their threats aside. Join me in continuing the progress we built.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen went head-to-head with Republicans on the House Ways and Means Committee. Yellen warned members against defaulting on the national debt and defended the administration's 2024 budget plan.
Our proposed budget builds on our economic progress by making smart, fiscally responsible investments.
House and Ways Chairman Jason Smith raised concerns about the roughly $80 million the IRS got in the Inflation Reduction Act, but he also criticized the performance of Yellen's agency, which the new funding aims to improve.
The Treasury Department is woefully falling short in fulfilling its core mission.
The Federal Reserve, Treasury Department, and Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation announced that depositors at the Silicon Valley Bank and one other will be protected. The two banks have collapsed and are being taken over by regulators. New York Democrat Jamal Bowman is speaking against two bills he calls transphobic. The Protection of Women and Girls in Sports Act would ban transgender women from female sports, and the Parents' Bill of Rights Act would limit LGBTQ equality efforts in education. Bowman says transgender people should be able to live their lives and be who they want to be.
Let's stop discriminating against them simply because they are different from who we are and different than what we understand.
New York Representative George Santos stands accused of masterminding a 2017 credit card skimming operation that stole information from ATMs. A Brazilian man convicted of fraud told authorities Santos was responsible, which Santos denies. Likely presidential candidate Florida Governor Ron DeSantis was in Nevada over the weekend promoting his book Blueprint to Freedom, which details his accomplishments in Florida and his vision for the country.
Because woke ideology has infected so many institutions, if you really want to protect the freedom of your folks, you got to be willing to defend them against the left imposing their pathologies on your people.
Finally, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy told Fox News Sunday he'll slowly roll out access to tapes of the January 6th insurrection to other news outlets. McCarthy was criticized for releasing the footage to Fox News' Tucker Carlson. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our ATRUST indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
It's not good news for drivers as Portland traffic deaths tied their 30-year high in 2022. That's according to new statistics released by the Portland Bureau of Transportation, known as PBOT. 63 people died on Portland roads last year, and traffic safety experts say the data confirms where the problems lie. 70% of the fatal crashes in 2022 were on what the city calls the, quote, high crash network, even though it makes up only 8% of city streets. That high crash network is made up of 30 or so streets, and it's where PBOT has focused most of its resources. Speed was a major factor for traffic deaths as well. PBOT plans to add 20 new speed and red light cameras this year. The difference that speed makes when it comes to a car hitting a pedestrian is pretty significant. If someone is hit by a car going 20 miles an hour, they have just a 10% chance of being severely injured or dying. At 40 miles per hour, though, that jumps to 80%. Nearly half of traffic deaths last year happened on streets with 35 miles per hour speed limits. Changing speed limits can be a challenge, though, especially because Portland does not have direct control on some of its roads. The city has to apply to the state or to be allowed to raise the lower speed limits, which can take months to a year to be approved. Nearly three-quarters of traffic deaths were in low-light conditions. Think dawn, dusk, or nighttime. PBOT is also looking at more lighting improvements, especially in East Portland. PBOT data shows that someone walking in East Portland is more than two times more likely to be hit by a car than someone walking in Inner Portland. Dylan Rivera is a spokesperson for PBOT. Rivera told the Portland Mercury that, quote, when it comes to pedestrian deaths and people biking our streets, the person with the most responsibility and the most power in these instances is the person controlling 2,000 pounds of hard steel. There is no contest when steel meets human flesh. 28 pedestrians were killed on Portland roads in 2022, and 10 were homeless at the time of their death. That's 36% of pedestrian deaths, even though the houseless population makes up less than a percentage of the population of Multnomah County. This is the second year that PBOT has measured housing status and traffic fatalities. Staggering numbers in 2021, 70% of traffic deaths led Mayor Ted Wheeler to ban camping on high crash corridors. The number of homeless pedestrians who were killed dropped in 2022, but PBOT says it isn't enough data to know if the mayor's ban was effective. More than a dozen lawsuits have been filed recently by Black Portlanders who say they were discriminated against while shopping at various stores in the city. Willamette Week and Oregon Live report that all of the suits have been filed in Multnomah County Circuit Court on behalf of clients of the local law firm Cafuri and McDougal. The plaintiffs allege that they were aggressively profiled or discriminated against in Fred Meyer, Sephora, Home Depot, Walmart, and Safeway stores in the Portland area. Jordan Dinwiddie, a plaintiff in one of the lawsuits, said, quote, "It makes me not want to live here. Maybe this would have happened in Chicago where I'm from, but it didn't. It happened in the whitest city in America." Dinwiddie is a creative director for Wyden and Kennedy here in Portland, and she claims she was erroneously stopped by a security guard at the Sephora store on Southwest Morrison downtown. These suits come on the heels of a February decision by jurors to award $4.4 million in damages to a man who was racially profiled at the Walmart in Wood Village. Since that verdict, Cafuri and McDougal report their law firm's phones have been ringing off the hook with local people who say they've had similar experiences. Cafuri believes that an increase in shoplifting has made big box retailers more aggressive in checking receipts as customers leave the stores. However, that's also causing them to unfairly single out people of color in the process. The Norfolk Southern train derailment has prompted a lot of scrutiny from lawmakers about how the environmental disaster was caused. A bipartisan group of Pennsylvania lawmakers recently introduced new legislation, the Railway Safety Act of 2023. That's aimed at preventing future freight train derailments like the most recent one in East Palestine, Ohio. Supporters say the bill would help improve rail safety protocols to avoid harmful pollutants in the air and water. Danielle Smith has more details.
Hoping to avoid future train disasters like Norfolk Southern derailment in East Palestine, a bipartisan group of Pennsylvania lawmakers has introduced the Railway Safety Act of 2023. They say it would create more safety requirements for trains carrying hazardous materials, including a permanent requirement for railroads to operate with at least two-person crews, and increase the frequency of rail car inspections. The new legislation is a step in the right direction, says Nick Messenger with the Ohio River Valley Institute, but enforcement is key because some railroad regulations from past decades have still not been fully implemented.
The biggest thing that I think it does is it applies to a class of trains that are not currently classified as hazardous. One of the big issues in East Palestine was that this train, even though it had all of these chemical cars on it, because they were not linked together in a row, they were not actually classified as hazardous.
The new legislation would require state emergency personnel to be notified of what chemicals are on board train cars coming through their communities. Messenger points out that the derailment is part of a bigger story about the petrochemical industry in the region and residents' rights to clean air and water.
There are a lot of major concerns around this accident around what are called volatile organic compounds, VOCs, and those were kind of emitted into the air and into the water from the derailment. But they're also being emitted by lots of other industrial activity in the region, in addition to the Shell cracker plant that just went online in Beaver County, which is only about 35 miles from the derailment site.
Initially, Norfolk Southern offered the entire town a total of $25,000 to help with cleanup. Since then, lawsuits against the rail company are piling up. Last week, Norfolk Southern CEO Alan Shaw apologized during a U.S. Senate hearing and pledged the company will pay whatever the cost for a full cleanup of the disaster. I'm Danielle Smith, Keystone State News Connection.
Portland Audubon is one of the oldest and largest chapters of the National Audubon Society, but now it wants to drop the Audubon from its name. John James Audubon was an American artist and naturalist. He's best known for his book, The Birds of America, which was published in 1827 with 435 life-size bird watercolors. He was also a slaveholder. Audubon had 9 people enslaved at his home in Kentucky during his life, and he criticized the abolitionist movement, saying the United Kingdom had, quote, acted imprudently and too precipitously, end quote, in the emancipation of people in territories it controlled. Audubon also dug up Native American graves to sell skulls to people studying phrenology, which attempted to link head shapes with racial superiority. He wasn't directly connected to the naming of the National Society. Founder George Bird Grinnell chose the name to honor his tutor, Lucy Audubon, who was John James Audubon's widow. The Portland chapter owns 172 acres of woodland in the Northwest Hills, plus wildlife sanctuaries in Sandy and Yahats. Members do more than look at birds. They restore habitat, educate children, run a wildlife hospital, and fund a legal department that fought to protect the northern spotted owl. Stuart Wells is the group's executive director, and Wells acknowledges there are problems with what the name is associated with. While a number of staff and volunteers at Portland Audubon are people of color, including Wells, he says the name is inconsistent with its mission. Wells says that mission is one of inclusion and equity, and that the name can be a barrier to people of color, especially black people. He added dropping it might help more people feel welcome in nature. Portland Audubon's name change isn't the only one. Other institutions have addressed their problematic namesakes as well. High schools named for Presidents James Madison and Woodrow Wilson have also been renamed. Local society supporters have been waiting for the headquarters to drop the name, but that hasn't happened yet. Portland joins local chapters in Seattle, Chicago, and elsewhere that have dropped Audubon on their own. A new name for their chapter has not been selected yet. Cattle ranching isn't typically thought of as a sustainable, regenerative industry, but a new collaboration in Oregon is hoping to change that. Deborah Van Fleet has more.
The collaboration is composed of conservation nonprofit Sustainable Northwest, the 100-member ranching cooperative Country Natural Beef, and ranching technical services company Northway Ranch Services. They're all supporting Country Natural Beef's Grazewell program, designed to protect and regenerate the soil. Dallas Hall DeFries with Sustainable Northwest says her group's extensive data collection starts with a spatial analysis. This utilizes satellite imagery to observe trends over time in the amount of biomass, bare ground, and invasive species. They also do on-the-ground assessments at a minimum of 5 spots on each ranch, including testing the soil's ability to absorb water.
The key there is you want ground to absorb rain really quickly because then it prevents it from running off, and then the roots and everything can utilize that rain more effectively.
DeFries says ground that's continuously grazed becomes degraded with more bare and compacted ground, but with rotational grazing, cattle remain in an area only long enough to browse the grasses before being moved on. This allows the plants to recover, and since plants sequester carbon in their roots, also lowers the ranch's overall carbon footprint. I'm Deborah Van Fleet.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio, where they will answer the question, what is blue carbon and why should I care? At 6, it's Labor Radio. Prison Pipeline is at 6:30, and then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Your weather forecast, it's going to continue rainy and cool tonight with a low of 36. Tomorrow, a few showers, maybe some clearing in the afternoon with a high of 50. Right now, it looks like the sun might make an appearance again on Thursday. On this date in history, in 1969, Apollo 9, the third manned spaceflight, returned safely to Earth. It was also the first successful mission of NASA's lunar module. The quote of the day is from women's rights activist Susan B. Anthony, who died on this day in 1906. She said, quote, "I distrust those people who know so well what God wants them to do, because I notice it always coincides with their own desires." There will be no task force studying the welfare of Native children in South Dakota now that a bill for that purpose has failed in the legislature there. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The failure of a bill in South Dakota means there will be no task force studying the welfare of Native children in the state. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's CJ Keen checks in on what's next.
Native children make up a disproportionate number of children in the state's foster care system, which led to the initial interest in the study. Representative Puri Poyer, in a recent appearance on SDPB's In the Moment, says this has been on lawmakers' minds for some time.
This has been a longstanding issue for as long as I could remember, at least documented about 20 years. It's been at 60%. 60% of children in the system are Native children, and they wanted to come together and address it.
Poyer says the issue requires involvement from state government.
Where do we go from now? Well, we got to go back to the drawing table. The fight never ends until positive outcomes happen for Native children. And a lot of people will probably say, I hear this time and time again, why don't the tribes just fix it on their own? We are South Dakotans as well. Yes, we have tribal nations, but there are Native children all across the state of South Dakota.
It's an issue that touches every corner of South Dakota's Native community. Lower Burrell Sioux Tribe Chairman Clyde Estes thanked the bill sponsors. He says he doesn't expect this issue to go away after the session.
With some of the sponsors of the bill and the support we have on a tribal and some of our state supporters, that we'll bring this issue back up again. The fact of the matter is, thus, as tribal and state leaders need to find a better path forward to work together to put aside our differences to do what's best for all South Dakota children.
SB 191 died on the floor of the state house, just one step away from the governor's desk. Opponents raised concerns over costs and the members making up the committee. For National Native News, I'm CJ Keen in Rapid City.
A bipartisan bill in Congress aims to bolster tribal law enforcement and combat the epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous people. As Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, the effort would enhance access to data and increase officer retention.
The Badges Act is designed to increase tribal access to the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System and conduct training and information gathering to improve the resolution of missing persons cases. Tribal police often face roadblocks because of a lack of access to federal crime data. The bill would also allow the Bureau of Indian Affairs to conduct its own background checks to improve the process of hiring officers. Arizona Representative Ruben Gallego is a co-sponsor of the bill.
We need to empower these communities to protect themselves and give them their opportunity to really bring safety to their community, and doesn't just necessarily have to happen from us at the federal level.
Gallego hopes the bill will help with officer recruitment and retention on tribal nations by offering more access of culturally appropriate mental health and wellness programs to BIA officers and tribal police, and by mandating a report on tribal law enforcement needs. Through the Badges Act, a grant program would be established to support state and tribal investigations of missing and murdered persons and sexual assault cases. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff, Arizona.
As of Monday morning, three Alaska Native mushers were battling it out for the top spot in the Iditarod, the 1,000-mile sled dog race from Anchorage to Nome. Ryan Reddington, an Inupiat with roots in Unalakleet, has been out in front in the last stretch of the race. 2019's Iditarod champ, Pete Kaiser, remains in second place. Kaiser is Yupik from Bethel. Richie Deal, a Denina Athabascan from Aniak, was in third. Another Native musher, Mike Williams Jr., Yupik from Akiak, remains in the back of the pack, keeping a steady pace. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Florida's labor unions are sounding alarms over proposed legislation that aims to change how union dues and fees are collected for some public employees in the state. While proponents claim it encourages face-to-face communication with their union reps, opponents argue it will reduce the number of employees with representation and could threaten academic freedom. Trimble Gomes has more on that story.
Union leaders and public sector workers say bills advancing in the Florida legislature, if passed, will strip them of their representation and could also do the same for academic freedom. Speaking in committee last week, Florida State University professor Joseph Helweg says he used to recruit for his union, United Faculty of Florida, and heard a variety of reasons why some of his colleagues chose not to pay their dues. He disagrees with the proposal that would require 60% instead of 50% of workers eligible for union representation be dues-paying members in order for the union to remain certified.
You will essentially be attacking workers' freedoms, not defending them. And I fear that one reason for this bill is, in fact, to undermine academic freedom by ending tenure, which could happen since UFF is the only reason tenure exists.
Republican Senator Blaise Ingolio of Spring Hill sponsors the bill, which would also remove the automatic deductions of dues from union member paychecks, claiming it would promote more face-to-face conversations with their union representatives. Opponents have also criticized the bill because the changes does not apply to unions for law enforcement, correctional officers, probation officers, or firefighters. President of the Florida Education Association, Andrew Sparr, says Senate Bill 256 limits teachers' freedoms, and he believes Governor Ron DeSantis is retaliating against those who speak up.
By being that group of individuals who speak out for students, they have become a target. You know, this governor has made it clear. He targets anyone that he believes is in his way or anyone that speaks out against what he wants to do.
The proposals are no stranger to union advocates. It's simply the latest version of similar legislation that has been introduced by Florida lawmakers since at least 2011. The difference is that Republicans have control over both of Florida's chambers, so it's expected to pass. The proposals could affect more than 150,000 working people in Florida who are represented by unions. This is Tramell Gomes for Florida News Connection.
Washington State has become the first state in the nation to offer students climate change education. It's having great results in the Camas School District. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Washington State is supporting climate change education in the classroom like nowhere else. With the state's ClimeTime program, Washington is the first state in the nation to put money behind learning about climate change for K-12 students. Allie Coker is a science teacher at Camas High School who developed a lesson from professional development with ClimeTime. She says Camas is a semi-rural area close to agriculture, so she focused on that with one of the units she taught.
Try to figure out different ways of farming and different ways of doing agriculture that would impact the climate less, so it was problem solving, but also putting themselves where they were thinking about what it would be like to be in that situation.
Coker says her students were so excited about the lessons, they have been doing their own research outside of the classroom on the topic. Nearly a dozen other states have legislation pending related to climate change education. After a push from Governor Jay Inslee, state lawmakers signed off on funding the ClimeTime program for the 2018 school year. Last year, the legislation increased the program's budget to $5 million. Ellen Ebert with the Office of Superintendent of Public Instructions started ClimeTime 5 years ago. Because the state's geography is so varied, she says the program takes a hyper-local approach.
We started to study our communities that we were working with, and the professional learnings became tailored to the needs of the community.
Ebert says as the science changes, the ClimeTime program is evolving as well to include updates. Becky Bronstein is with EarthGen, which partners with the schools on climate change programming, especially the ways it intersects with social justice. She says not completely focusing on the bleaker aspects of the crisis is crucial.
It's really important for us to not only build knowledge for students about what's really happening, what's the science behind this, but how can we equip you to feel empowered and have agency around these topics so that you can do something about it.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
More environmental news as environmental activists have kept a steady presence at the Eversource electrical substation in East Boston. They say the utility company is knowingly building the high-voltage project in a floodplain, posing a risk to nearby communities. Protesters are calling on Governor Maura Healey to intervene. Catherine Carley reports.
Environmental activists are calling on Governor Maura Healey to end construction of the Eversource electrical substation in East Boston and move it to Massport, which will utilize most of the generated power. The activists say the utility is knowingly building the high-voltage project in a floodplain, posing health and safety risks to the surrounding community. State Senator Lydia Edwards says local residents should not pay for energy meant to power Logan Airport. support.
This is all about them. It has never been about our community. It has never been about what we need or want.
Edwards says the project runs counter to the Commonwealth's landmark climate law, which requires environmental justice factors be considered when siting infrastructure projects, and residents say they are already overburdened with industrial pollution. Eversource says the substation is needed to meet the area's growing energy demands. Healy has previously expressed her opposition to the substation, and members of her cabinet have committed to reviewing all legal procedures related to its construction. But activists like Alex Chambers of the climate justice group Extinction Rebellion says nearly 84% of voters already rejected the project in a 2021 ballot initiative.
It's a real insult that the state government has allowed this to go forward. We should be creating more green space for people to use, not allocating it to investor-owned utilities like Eversource.
Chambers says activists will continue to practice civil disobedience at the construction site while appealing to Healy to intervene. Boston Mayor Michelle Wu has already publicly opposed the project. For Commonwealth News Service, I'm Catherine Carley. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 13th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem. The producer is Michelle Coppola, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Deborah Van Fleet, Antonia Gonzalez, and Catherine Carley. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola. Remember, all of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members, great people like you. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.